Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio. Today is the summer solstice in the land of the midnight sun up here in Alaska, and on this week's episode, we have Iditarod veteran Mitch Seavey calling in. Mitch, how's it going?
It's going very well. Thank you, Robert.
Thanks for joining us this evening. Where are you calling in from?
Well, I happen to be in Anchorage today, sitting high atop the inlet towers, but I'm usually hanging out in Sterling and Seward this time of year.
Very cool. And we're definitely going to talk a little bit about your guys' business down there in the Seward area here in a little bit, but I want to congratulate you on your Iditarod run this year, seventh place. How was the race for you this year?
Well, seventh place is kind of an average average run for me. I would like to have done better, but certainly could have done worse too. So I'm not ecstatic, but you know, we'll take what we can get. And of course, I was happy with the person who did win.
Of course, you know, your son Dallas, he was on our show right after the Iditarod was over in early April, and definitely an awesome win for him. You got to be proud of him, huh?
I certainly am, and, you know, that's something that he's been shooting for a long time. Even though he's a young guy, he's been mushing a long time and dreaming about that Iditarod win, so we couldn't be prouder of him.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that family. Arguably, you guys are the dynasty of Iditarod, I guess, if you call it. You had three generations in this year's race with your dad, Dan, and, of course, yourself, and Dallas running this year. How was it like for that much CV to be running in the race at one time?
You know, you attach terms like dynasty and all that sort of stuff, but I think you have to mix that with a certain amount of insanity, because it's just it's a crazy thing when you have that much going on. And really, you know, we just love mushing dogs and have literally been involved since the first race to Nome. And so we just keep doing what we do. And, you know, thankfully, a lot of the kids and, you know, even daughter-in-law has run it. We've just loved the Iditarod and running dogs all these years. And again, thankfully, Dad's in his mid-70s and still mushing strong and ran the Iditarod again. So these things are just happening. And I think the greatest, you know, mushing dynasty has got to be the Reddingtons, and Joe Reddington Sr. always deserves the kudos about the Iditarod race. But we're just thankful to be able to keep participating.
You know, when I was speaking with Dallas on the show, he talked about how you guys talk about mushing around Thanksgiving table when other people are talking about the Cowboys and the Lions on TV and the parades and that sort of stuff. How is it there at the family table with all of that mushing knowledge and back and forth going on, you know, in your guys' family?
Well, you know, growing up in the sticks without television and, you know, barely internet until recently, it's kind of, we're a little isolated from the national games and so forth. But, yeah, the guys, you know, my sons and dad and I, and, you know, we talk about dogs all the time, and the women folks sort of roll their eyes and go off and do something else. But it's just something that we're obsessed with it a little bit. And I think there could be worse things, though.
Of course. And you wrote a book a few years ago, Lead, Follow, or Get Out of the Way, I believe is the title. If it's not, please correct me. An excellent book. I try to pass that along to all of the, you know, the up-and-coming guys that ask me questions, whether it's on Facebook and things, because of the show. But you impart such knowledge in that book. Can you share a little bit about that, maybe a little bit about your philosophy? And, you know, we only have a half hour. We could probably talk for hours about it. But do you have a general philosophy about mushing that you could possibly share for some newcomers or up-and-coming mushers?
Well, yeah, it's hard to encapsulate it in brief statements, but yeah, that's the name of the book, Lead, Follow, or Get Out of the Way. And in a way, that title sort of summarizes what life is like if a dog were a wild dog in a pack. So, you know, in a lot of ways, that's how it works with racing and mushing as well. So we have high expectations for our dogs, and we find that through the excellent genetics that we have, we're able to bring all those dogs to their full potential, and they do find a place to fit in. So I think that's the idea, is that every dog's going to be in the team or in some team. We view sled dogs as being quite a bit different than the dogs that most people are attached to, so it's difficult to kind of convey some of those principles to folks that aren't really used to sled dogs, because they really do have a drive and a love and a desire to do what they do. And that said, then, training them often involves us just allowing them to do what they're naturally bred and born to do. And it's amazing how much we do as the musher and the human in the equation to almost interfere with our own dogs. And hopefully that book helps to bring out some of the ways that we can work with our dogs and work with their natural tendencies, and also how we can fit into their kind of society and the way a dog thinks and the way they operate, and put ourselves in a position where we really can be kind of co-partners with the dogs to do what we both love, and that is to run down the trail. So, I had a lot of fun writing the book. We've had good feedback, and we recommend it, of course, for anybody that's interested in mushing.
You know, I got a chance to sit down with Danny a couple of Iditarods ago when he was up at the Millennium, and also speaking with Dallas. You guys have a very technical outlook in the way that you approach mushing, at least your sons do. Do you have that same sort of background in the way you approach it, or is it a little bit different?
I think I'm just as technical, but I'm probably not as good at putting it into words. Those two boys, Danny and Dallas in particular, are practically lifelong tour guides, so they've perfected the ways to say things. And I probably am more intuitive and sense and feel how to do things with dogs, and maybe not able to quite voice it at the time, but there's nothing about our sport from our perspective that we haven't thought about. I'm not saying we got it right, but we sure have an opinion about it, whatever it is. And so, yeah, having done this since literally, my dad started in sled dogs before the 1964 earthquake, if that gives you some perspective.
Wow.
So we've certainly thought about all aspects. We have our opinions, albeit, admittedly, maybe not all correct, but yeah, we know what we think anyway.
How do you think that with your guys' tour business down there in Seward, how do you think that that helps your dogs perform in the Iditarod and mid-distance races and things that you guys may enter? I know that Conway did the junior Iditarod, sort of thing. How do you think that tour-type mentality that some of these dogs take part in helps you in the big races?
Well, it's debatable, honestly, whether it altogether helps every dog, but I see where it really does help the young dogs, and certainly for any dog, working in the tours all summer long is certainly a better option than doing nothing all summer long. For my older race dogs, I actually prefer for them to have quite a bit of downtime in the summer, because they work so hard in the winter and put on a lot of miles. I like for them to have more downtime and just easy runs, occasional use. I like to put my main race dogs into the tours right during the peak of the tour season to help out, but not for long periods of time. But I do see where it really teaches our dogs to pull, and it muscles up and builds up those young dogs. So, yeah, there's definitely that advantage. And then also just the fact that there's something going on. They're being handled, they're being worked with, they're being mentally stimulated. By the time they've been through tours and a couple of years of training, there's really nothing that surprises them anymore. So I do think it helps to develop a more well-rounded dog. And obviously the physical part, doing the work, helps the young dogs too.
Well, you mentioned that some of those guys do have quite a bit of downtime in the summer months, and of course, today being the solstice and the longest day here in Alaska. How do you guys spend your summers as a group in terms of preparing for? You said you think about everything, and I'm sure you guys are not only the experts on what you guys do, but also consummate students as well. What do you guys do in the off time as preparation for the following year's races?
Well, the summertime, of course, is a time where we're doing breedings and we're raising pups. We've, you know, in the springtime before really the tour season starts, we've harness broke everybody that's at that age. But honestly, a big part of summer, and I think a lot of folks can relate to this whether you're in mushing or not, but a big part of the summer is scrambling hardcore to make enough money to keep doing this.
Right.
And so, you know, really racing does take a back seat, and tours and doing your job and doing your work. We have one son that's a commercial fisherman, and he's, you know, working literally 24 hours a day sometimes. And so, I mean, we do like everybody and try to make hay while the sun shines. But, you know, fortunately, we're doing a lot of that with dogs. So we try to work that in with the racing. You know, this is a time of year where you might have time to build a new dog sled or modify your sled as you were thinking last year, you know, during the race, or certainly you can do a certain amount of leader training in the summertime. We've got a couple of good places to take dogs out in small teams and do a lot of stopping and going, and you know that can be done in the warmer weather, but a lot of equipment things can be done. But you know, as I say, mostly it's about, you know, taking advantage of whatever it is that we do to make an income.
So when do you guys start training for the following year? Is it as soon as the temperature drops? Do you guys have a set time? You often hear, you know, the 1st of October is kind of the rule of thumb for a lot of mushers. When do you guys start that preparation for the following year in terms of training?
Right about there. You know, many times I've started the 1st of September, but then it gets interrupted badly for hunting season, and I wonder if I shouldn't have just held off and waited, you know, to start a little bit later. I honestly think in the fall the most important factor is the temperature. We can fool around doing real short runs and stop and go, but if it's too warm, we're probably at risk of doing more harm than good. And especially if the dogs have been working in some sort of tours, or for folks who don't do tours, if they've been able to loose run their dogs, or you know, even take them, you know, on a bike or something a little bit during the summer so they get some activity. I think you can just about, you know, you're not falling behind, let's put it that way, if you wait until it's cool enough weather. Now, in the tours, because our tour is relatively short, it's 2 miles or less, the ride that we do, and because we stop and go, all the folks with the cameras and wanting to get their picture with the dogs and with the scenic spots where we stop and that. So there's a lot of stopping, so the dogs don't really get too hot. But if I'm going to take a dog team for a training run where I'm going to want to go, say, 5 miles or more, I don't even go if it's warmer than 50 degrees and preferably colder than that. And that would probably be if, you know, there's some wind or rain and some puddles on the trail to get into. So unless it's that kind of conditions or cooler, I think you're really kind of wasting your time or maybe doing more harm than good in those fall runs.
Right. You know, I like to talk to you veteran guys about the state of mushing and what do you guys see coming up in the future. On our first show, our inaugural show here on Mushing Radio at Radio Free Palmer, we had on the publisher of Mushing Magazine, Greg Sullivan. We talked about the state of mushing and what he thinks is going to come. So I pose that question to you, Mitch. What do you see happening here in the next 5-10 years with not only the Iditarod but mushing as a sport?
Okay, well, mushing as a sport, of course, like other sports, depends on money. And money has been hard to come by for the sport, either in terms of prize money or in some cases sponsorships or the income that we make or that the race organizations have. It's all been hard to come by, but I think it has a lot to do with communicating with the public and with our fans, and it's hard to get our story out and get our event on TV, you know, and we're not selling season tickets to a stadium, so I'm not sure that I have a specific answer for you, but I think with electronic media and more interaction with Facebook and things, that more and more people are going to be able to get inside the sport and appreciate it. So I guess I have reason to see optimism for, you know, more and more contact with our fans, and that will generate a more income for the sport, which in turn then will make it more viable for us to, you know, expand and have more teams in events, more prize money, more races, things like that.
What does your dad say, Dan Seavey, ran in the first sets of Iditarods way back in the 70s, and here he is running in 2012. What does he say about the sport and how it's evolved over the last 40-some-odd years?
Well, I think, you know, he's an interesting guy because he on one side, he really likes the old ways. I think he would be just as happy if we still had, you know, sleds made out of driftwood and tied together with rawhide, and we were, you know, maybe he would like to see a rule where we have to wear fur or something, you know. But on the other hand, I talked him into riding a sit-down sled this year, you know, and he's got all the good gear and the modern things, and I think at the end of the day, he appreciates the innovations and the advancements that have been made. But when it's all said and done, I think he's really a master at understanding sled dogs, and, you know, he's made the comment many times that the same as back in 1973, a good dog is a good dog, and that's what the sport is really all about.
Exactly. Do you see anything up and coming in terms of, you know, you often hear it through the grapevine about, you know, how the Iditarod may change, like a veterans-only race and, you know, a race for the rookies and that sort of thing, instead of just the camping trip that some people sign up to do. Do you see anything like that happening with the Iditarod in the coming future?
Well, I don't have any crystal ball on that. I think in some ways, it would be helpful if the race did have more adaptation specific to, you know, rookies and newcomers into the race, where maybe it wasn't all in one big pot. But on the other hand, you know, that's kind of what the allure of the race is. And, you know, I think there was more of a movement for that when we were seeing 90 and up close to 100 entrants. And, you know, we have to kind of control this somehow. In recent years, though, there's been pretty comfortable number of teams. I think the race organization can handle 60 or 70 teams in a race, all in one category. The recent changes requiring more qualifying miles and report cards and things, I think, are helpful so that the rookies that are in the race are more qualified to run maybe more closely with the veterans. So I guess I can't foretell or predict. I think if there was more money on the race and things like that, then I think we might see more of those things happen.
Right, and definitely not trying to put you on the spot at all, Mitch. I'm just trying to get your feedback, being one of those veterans from back in the day, I guess you could say. So I just figured that we would ask you some of those questions if you didn't mind. Let's talk about this year's Iditarod. Seventh place this year, which you said was definitely a respectable finish for you. How did the race go for you? You know, there's all that media talk during the race about you and Dallas mushing together and that sort of thing. And then, of course, the race changed. But how did it go for you out there on the trail? Tell us a little bit about the 2012 Iditarod.
Okay. I guess you know, I wasn't real pleased with coming in seventh, and I was, you know, in Nome kind of, you know, still sleep deprived. And I hope I was a gentleman, but I made it known that, you know, I wasn't too happy with that. And one rather wise young rookie honestly said to me, yeah, you know, I hate that when I come in the top 10. So I had to kind of learn a lesson there and learn to be a little more grateful. And so I am thankful. And again, I'm in the top 10, you know, but I really had hopes to win the Iditarod. And so my team was an excellent team, although I had half young dogs, half of them were rather unproven. And I trained them harder than I've ever trained a dog team before, and I thought they were ready to go do things a step beyond where I had what I had done before. So I, even though I saw some signs of some sick dogs early, even before my 24 and so forth, we were having a little bit of trouble. I thought that, you know, gee, a team that's been trained this hard, this isn't going to set them back. We're just going to, you know, step it up a notch and take this race by the horns. And it didn't work out. The dogs got more sick and ended up slowing down quite a bit and still did a good effort and did a good job, and I'm proud of them. As compared to Dallas's team, you know, he had a team that he thought could win. He was pretty confident could win, but only if he was to kind of baby them and take it easy and watch them build and develop on the trail. And lo and behold, you know, that worked out for him. And he, you know, honestly won the Iditarod with a lot of dogs that had come from my kennel that I didn't even really choose to work with. So that was kind of an interesting turn of events. But you know, the Iditarod is so intriguing because there are so many facets, and who knows what's really going to happen. So at the end of the day, you have to just, you know, love the dogs and enjoy the sport, take the best you can from it.
Was it a good race for you in terms of trail conditions and that sort of thing, or could it be better?
Well, the trail conditions were fine. I mean, they are what they are. I'm, you know, really many, many years beyond really griping about the trail. It was fine. It was there. You could see it. You knew where to go. It was marked. And, you know, it was a little bit tougher pull than sometimes because cold weather results in, you know, crystally cold, squeaky snow that doesn't pull very well. But everybody was running in that snow. So, no, in fact, those type of things should be an advantage for me with a hard-pulling, powerful team that I have. So, no, it was not particularly hard.
For our new fans out there, I definitely want to get your take on some advice for newer mushers or folks coming up. Can you describe a little bit, we haven't asked this question yet to all of our guests that's been on, the differences between the northern route and the southern route. Is there any big difference between each route and people deciding whether they should run their rookie run on which one they should pick?
Yeah, there are some differences, and I guess a lot of that depends on the weather. In certain weather conditions, you know, there's not a lot of difference because it's going to be deep snow or new soft trail either way you go. But the big snow machine race goes on the northern route, and so at least there is some base on that trail from Ophir to Ruby and down to Caltag. When we go the southern route, you go through a couple of hundred miles there where until the Iditarod comes there every other year, nobody ever goes there. You know?
Yeah.
And so there can be quite a bit of trail with no base, maybe just a couple of snow machine tracks over it, and the first couple of teams enjoy that kind of crust, that base, that thin base that's put in. After a couple of teams, it's broken down, and you might just be floundering, and there's no bottom there. So the southern route can be a little tougher that way. But there again, you know, if you're prepared to run the Iditarod, you should be prepared for whatever kind of trail is there. But, yeah, that's a good question. And typically, I guess I would say the northern route, dirt for that part of the race might be just a little easier. And the other thing, if you're trying to race competitively, you have to look at the mileages and the distance between Takotna, Ophir, and Cripple. That shot, if you're going northern route, and then Takotna, Ophir, and Iditarod is a little longer going the southern route. So that's a real key spot there as to whether you're, you know, where you're stopping, where you're taking your 24, whether you camp in between, those sorts of questions.
So let's talk about one piece of advice. I try to ask all of you guys that are on our show, if you can impart one piece of advice to the up-and-coming musher, whether it's the recreational guy with two and three dogs in the backyard that, you know, he might just take for a spin in the, you know, in the neighborhood woods, up to a guy that may be doing some mid-distance stuff. What is one piece of advice you can add to these guys?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. If I only get one, right? I wrote a book about this.
I know you did.
One piece of advice is read the book, Lead, Follow, or Get Out of the Way. No, honestly, though, I think it would have to be that you, whether you're a recreational guy or right on up to a guy like Dallas who, you know, won the Quest last year and Iditarod this year and seems to be on top right now, you have to, and I guess this is part of his success, you have to have realistic expectations of your dogs. You have to drive what's in front of you. And just because you think you want to be Rookie of the Year or top 20 doesn't really change what you're driving or what their capabilities are. So especially entering, breaking into racing, and it's easy for me to relate it to the Iditarod, but you have to identify what kind of dog team you have and then run them on that kind of a schedule. If you take off thinking that you're going to keep up with Dallas or keep up with Lance Mackey or keep up with, you know, one of the top guys, and your dogs aren't up to that, then you're going to come out far worse off than if you took it much, much easier and lo and behold, they're stronger at the end and you can pass a few teams and improve.
Right.
For rookies, it's far more success and accomplishment, and you'll get more pats on the back and more attaboys from the old-timers in the race if you complete a successful race with a nice-looking dog team in good health and good spirits than, say, you have a bedraggled-looking little remnant of a dog team and straggle in there in 20th place. Most people will say, so what? You didn't treat your dogs well. If you took that same team and finished 40th and had most of them still there barking and looking good, then people would be proud of you for that.
I think that's great advice to the rookies. You know, it's not necessarily that finishing place that matters so much. It's that dog team that is important. Mitch, we have about a minute to go. Anything you want to say in parting here?
Well, I just thank you for having me on. It's been a good time. And, you know, everybody should be getting their gear all ready and looking forward to cooler weather in the fall so we can get back at it.
Sounds good. Actually, we do have a couple of more minutes. My okay. Producer here was just giving me the finger signs there. So let's just delve into this just a second more in terms of that advice that you can give. And again, I know your book's been out for a couple of years, but it is one heck of a reference for those news guys and even guys like me who hasn't run the Iditarod but is, you know, trying to get his feet wet at least a little bit. I learned a heck of a lot from that book. Was that necessarily a journey for you, or did you just sit down and just crank it out?
It's just a compilation of things that I'm aware of over the years. I didn't have to do a lot of research for it, so I don't know what you mean by a journey. But one of the things that's included in there is about, selecting and breeding dogs. And I think there's another aspect that goes with that, with the realistic expectations of your dog team. I think people that are new into the sport should really resist the temptation to breed a lot of dogs. I hate to see a lot of dogs around that don't end up meeting people's expectations later on. So that might be another bit of advice to add to that. And that's covered in that book, too.
Sure, sure. And one last thing, your guys' website, iditaride.com. Are you involved in the day-to-day business down there? I know you're in Sterling and the business operation is in Seward. Do you have your hand in it in the day-to-day operations as well?
Well, the day-to-day operation is run by our oldest son, Danny, and even though I own the company that he works for, in a practical sense, I work for him. So I run and fetch and carry and haul dogs and bring dog food and things like that. He runs the day-to-day operation, so I'm not in Seward every day. I'm there fairly often, but no, they don't have me in the tour rotation anymore. I got fired from that a few years ago.
So how is it like working for your kid?
It's excellent because he's a good kid and very smart. A lot of things he does way better than me, and I'm willing to admit that. So I just do what he tells me.
Very cool.
It works out good.
Very cool. Well, Mitch, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us today. I know you're calling from the road there, but we'll definitely send over a link to you on email, and you can do with it as you wish. Put it on your website or on the Facebook or whatever you like, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That was Mitch Seavey calling in today. We are on Mushing Radio. MushingRadio.com is the place for the podcast after this show, so we will see you guys next time. Goodbye.